and brightest day, in blackest night, all other podcasts tremble in fright. Losers cower before the power. Orange is lust, and blues you can trust. Indigos feel, and white ones heal. Yellow scare, and green ones dare. That sapphire love and black hands glove will rock your foundation without hesitation. Chad and Mars face evil's might. Respect their power, for they'll make you see the light.
Hi, everybody. I'm Chad Bokelman.
I'm Mark Marble.
And this is the Lantern Cast.
Episode 560.
That's right. What are we talking about tonight?
Well, I would rather talk about the finale of Alan Scott one more time, but unfortunately, it's time to do War Journal number 9.
It's not that bad. At least we get a lot more information.
No, I mean, I'm being somewhat facetious. This is probably the best issue since the Ulgrin reveal issue, which was still a good issue. It just ended horribly and just ruined everything. But the issue, but that was the last probably good issue we had of this book, and this probably is on that level. So it is actually a step up from what we've gotten the last 2 months.
Not my favorite cover, but I'll be
no.
I'll be honest. When I think about it, though, what it's homaging in terms of like classic horror comics covers and stuff, I think that's, you know, with the word bubbles and a monster coming out and a scared person on the front cover, even the lettering chosen for Terror of the Star Shroud and everything, it's definitely homaging some classic horror comics there. So
yeah, Varin's the only good part of this cover as far as I'm concerned, but yeah.
All right, so our writer is Philip Kennedy Johnson, our artist is Montos, our colorist is Adriana Lucas, letterer Dave Sharp, cover artist by Montos and Pasquale Ferrara. Let's see here. We have variant cover artists Mike Perkins and Mike Spicer? And assistant
Spicer.
Editor, Spicer. Spicer. Assistant editor Jillian Grant and editor Paul Kaminsky. So...
Do you need to take a drink?
Another one? No, I'm good. This one's called Myth and Legend. How do I want to do this? Okay, so this is all being told as Shepard is in Guy Gardner's apartment, trying to catch up on the story of the Radiant Dead or the Revenant Queen, which neither of which search terms seem to be working for the Book of Oa, but he does ask about the earliest mention of the Dark Stars. This gives us our kind of narrative structure for this whole issue in terms of this story about that we'll recap here in a minute about the first mention of the Dark Stars recorded in the Book of Oa is playing from the moment you open this book until the moment we close out the story. So let's talk about what's actually in the story, and then I'll talk about what's talking over it. So over in the Dark Star area, on the other side of the star where John is sequestered with these alien individuals, he's helping lead the battle and defend the people as much as he can. He makes a little construct bridge to get them from one point to another. One of their fighters is straggling behind and is sick of some kind. And they say he's not coming. He's turning into the Fen. John's like, hey, we don't leave a soldier behind. He explains what's happening to him and that there's nothing that can be done. So they leave him behind. Meanwhile, over in Metropolis at the Steelworks Tower, we have Ellie and her and John's mother, playing some dice. And John's mother has a moment of lucidity in thinking back about referring to Ellie in the past tense, how she used to play dice and make little pictures with anything with the dice. And she thinks about it anytime they play a dice game. And Ellie's like, well, what do you mean? I'm right here. And John Stewart's mother goes to lay down and Ellie lights up and floats over the construct house with the soldiers and says, I'm not going to let the bad man hurt you. And the, why do I keep forgetting this guy's name? Cause he's now like, is he even, who he was before, because he's just matter and he's transforming into other people?
Probably not, but it's still Varin.
All right. So Varin is attacks Ellie. She falls to the ground. He says, "You're an aspect of Jon Stewart and you'll die as such, as will the mother." That's where we leave that situation. Meanwhile, the combatants, I guess is the only thing to really call them, of the Darkstar come back and they start searching for and trying to attack the team down here. On the other side of the Darkstar, he talks to Jon Stewart, talks to Byla about, you know, "Hey, who are you?" He says, "I betrayed a brother." And he said the thing that he did to save John, there's only one time he can do it. John's like, "Well, if I went back into the Darkstar and beat her ass and got that ring from her, what then?" He's like, "Well, that trick only worked once. It's not worth it." So on and so forth. Constructs, beings, creatures, whatever, find Jon Stewart and these alien people and attack them. They all start to fight back. John lights up, looks at the Darkstar, looks up at the Darkstar, looks down at Byla. Byla says, "Don't." He says, "Keep telling me what I can't do." And he flies off towards the Darkstar and into it as he himself becomes all green in the process, thinking of his mother. And it says, "Next, the will of Olgrin." Now, the entire story being told from the Book of Oa throughout this is that once upon a time, and I will do my best not to actually read any of this, because for my first read through, I'll admit this confused the hell out of me. I had to read this a couple of times to understand what it was actually saying. Malthusians at one point went out looking in the universe for powers. They went into an uncharted section of space and passed through kind of an area that was shrouded in dark matter. In that area, they found a crypt that was guarded by what's called it's referred to as a watchkeeper, but it turned them away. It's even listed here as formidable. Okay. So the Malthusians could not get past it. You know, the city's sacred. It can't be desecrated. Lest the will of the Elder God be awakened. But Malthusians being what they are, they didn't take no for an answer, kept pressing the matter until they got in there. And a light appeared and began to grow after they imprisoned the Watchkeeper. And that light is the Darkstar of the Fen. Meanwhile, after once they were in there, they mined the place that they found in this uncharted space that the Watchkeeper was guarding for the precious stone and metal that was there. And when somebody who is very willful held it, it transformed into light and will. And so they fashioned it into many tools. It says a belt, a helm, so like a helmet, a gauntlet, we know what that is, and a pauldron. A pauldron is one of those things you see like when knights or whatever are wearing like one very bulky side shoulder piece. That's a pauldron. So they became heroes for a little bit, these Malthusians who wielded the gauntlet, the helm, the pauldron, the belt, so on and so forth. And they were heroes for a little bit, doing their thing throughout the universe. The Malthusians were trying to do the thing that, you know, they ended up doing with the the Green Lantern Corps eventually. But their will that they used to control these weapons wasn't the only will that had access to them. And eventually the light awakened and started growing. Sort of, I guess, kind of like the concept of Parallax hiding in the battery, being, you know, kind of dormant for a while and slowly gaining sentience and control over the story goes, over a long period of time. That's kind of the vibe I got here. And we can talk about that in a little bit. So the legend of the Knights of the Darkstar and everything, it grew. And so did the Darkstar's power itself. And eventually it took over. In an attempt to control the power, the captain of the Malthusians, who was leading this whole expedition in the first place, went into the crypt, opened it up, the Queen's crypt, and, quote, claimed the vessel of Olgrin's will, and that was the Queen's ring. And when the captain died, she brought the sacred necropolis to ruin. and her living corpse became the weapon of Olgrin's wrath. So the female, it's kind of six of one, half a dozen of the other, whether it's the Malthusian captain or it's actually the queen, the daughter of Olgrin, or one in the same, two beings inhabiting one body or whatever. But these beings now are on the other side. They're manifestations of all the people who've ever tried to get into the necropolis, of all of people who fought alongside Olgrin once upon a time, a long, long time ago, and the Malthusians who died trying to get access to this power. The original Dark Star Knights who were trying to be heroes for a little bit, anybody who died trying to get in there, the captain, and so on and so forth. So that is what the first mention of the Dark Stars is in the Book of Oa. And I think that's the best I can do it.
That's fairly dead on, so you did well.
I like that. It's working kind of as a JeffCon, because when I was reading it, whether it was the third or fourth time or whatever, when I was reading it at the point I finally got it enough to recap it without having to actually read the whole thing out loud, it made me think of, like, okay, this could have been one of the Guardian secrets that we never got. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, yeah, is Philip Kennedy Johnson writing it in that light? Does he know of all that? Probably not. But, like, you know, I have no problem thinking about that. I do like that there's a bit of a backstory to it. Montos freaking killing it on this double page spread. The detail on this necropolis and the watchkeeper and the statue of the dying queen and all that stuff. Really crazy art, not just on the double page spread, but throughout the whole thing. Lots of detail. So I thought that was cool. Yeah, what'd you think?
Well, I agree. The artwork, the best artwork in the book is everything related to telling us the lost history of the Dark Stars and where they came from, and, you know, why because of the legend, that's why the controllers named their attempted police force or whatever. That's why they called them the Dark Stars, in reference to the original Knights and everything else. So, and which they do, obviously, as the story is being told, they tie the short-lived experiment of the Dark Stars into they without naming Jon Stewart, they're talking about Jon Stewart being, you know, basically being the like the champion, or the one who kind of like stood out and kind of made a legend for himself in his own right. So the backstory, the JeffCon stuff is fine as far. I mean, it's a little late. It's a little late getting 9 issues into a book that's dead and ends at 12 to finally give us something that's really tied, deeply tied to Green Lantern mythology. And the idea that, yes, based on the way I think you're supposed to read what the Book of Oa is telling Shepard, is that, yes, the Malthusian captain is the one who became at least the initial embodiment of the Revenant Queen. Mm-hmm. So that is actually a tie to Green Lantern mythology, not really tie. So when you think about it, there is a tie to Green Lantern mythology with the Revenant Queen and the Radiant Dead. And there actually isn't a tie to Jon Stewart because of the Dark Star thing. It's just really craply handled that it took us 9 issues to get it. And at a point where the book is already kaput and nobody really cares all that much. So again, editorial, this would have been so much better if some of this reveal would have come earlier in the book, or the Olgrin reveal would have come later in the book. So we at least would have been invested in some of this origin without getting all the point hole, everything being dropped here now. But again, that's the most interesting part of the book. The stuff with Ellie Rose is barely anything in this book about it, but it's still interesting. The Shepard stuff's really kind of been, I mean, I know it's a plot device for him to just basically be reading the Book of Oa, and we get to see what he's reading, what it's telling him. But it seems like Shepard's story really has been kind of neutered ever since Jon Stewart got pulled into that other dimension. And that's a problem, because they were so inherently tied, because not just because of Jon Stewart's reputation and whatever ties Shepard had with a Jon Stewart where he came from, it's the fact that Jon Stewart had the power, but despite his inexperience, Shepard had the knowledge. Shepard knew what they were dealing with and had the experience of dealing with this threat, while Jon Stewart didn't, and they worked well together as a team. And it wouldn't be as big a deal if Guy was physically here teaming up with Shepard, as opposed to being a disembodied voice that just says a couple of things to him says a couple of things to him each issue up to this point. At the end of the day, the weakest part still remains the stuff with Jon Stewart and the Dark Star of the Fen universe. It's like, seems like every single issue since he's been there, we have to have one point when he's talking to what's his face, and he says, "You got to help me get out of this universe." And he says, "No, if we do that, then all this evil gets freed, and nothing will be able to contain it." So it's kind of like we keep going back into the circle to a certain extent, and we know it doesn't get resolved really anytime soon based on the solicits. It's a better issue. It might be so objectively, it's a little too little, too late, but it's certainly. I'm glad that it didn't keep going downward massively, where between both of us, we would be banging our head against the wall every single time we had to like open one of these issues.
Yeah. Do you think Byla is the Watchkeeper? I kind of got that reading this. The immortal Watchkeeper had warned the Malthusians. They talk about him being imprisoned. And then later on, John asks, like, you know, what did you do to get stuck out here?
But he said he betrayed a brother.
Right. And that's not part of the story we get, but it's interesting, especially if you look, is this the same thing I'm saying? I'm sorry, I got a page back for a second here. Yeah, we kind of see it. So on that double page spread, you can see, you know, the Watchkeeper, big wings. Obviously, that doesn't look like Byla or whatever. But like, if you look to the left of that image, there's the start of this arch thing, and it's very reminiscent of a lot of stuff. But then you get to the page where Byla is telling him, "I betrayed a brother." On that same page, on that same page at the top, they're going through an archway that's got a lot of the same skull and design and stuff like that. I don't know if that's just like the Fen people doing their thing, but I don't know. There's a lot of coincidence there for us to be telling the story of this Watchkeeper who was imprisoned and gave them a warning and knows so much and all this. And only now in the same issue, John's asking is what you did to get stuck here. I don't know.
I mean, it's possible, but don't forget, you trace the, I'm trying to find the right word here, that the name of this guy is very similar to a similar name in Philip Kennedy Johnson's Werewolf thing.
Yeah, so maybe his brother. Yeah.
So my natural instinct is because let's be honest, a lot of this story is self-serving, referring back to what he wrote before. That to me is what I think is more likely, that we're going to find out the reason why their names are similar is because they're brothers but it's possible, but it's also, I mean, when you go back to that double page spread, it's also somewhat confusing to try to figure out to me. Really 100% who the Watchkeeper is really supposed to be, because you have like three really different pronounced images here. You got the guy in the bottom, you got the thing in the bottom with his claw outstretched, which to me might be because I'm assuming those are the Malthusians that are approaching him.
Those are definitely the Malthusians.
And then you have the upper image above that, which does look like, you know, almost like a skeleton with the wings. And then you also have the other thing, which I believe is supposed to be the crypt of the fallen goddess, daughter.
I think that's Olgrin holding his daughter.
Yeah, that's what I would assume. But on the left side of that, I'm not entirely sure about which one we're supposed to, because if you're looking at which one looks more like a living creature in a way, to me, I think the Skeletor looking guy looks more like the actual Watchkeeper. Then the other one looks like it's part of the actual crypt. But it's open to interpretation. But either way, it's possible. But based on the way the story's going, and again, it would suck in a way. It would suck if that's the case, because again, here's the book of Oa only knows what the book of Oa knows, that they're telling us we're getting all this backstory and all this origin just to find out like an issue or two later, "Oh, but we didn't tell you everything." I don't know. That would kind of be lame. Would I put it past the way kind of some of this is going so far for that to happen? No. But if I had to bet, I would probably bet that we're going to find out that he is the brother of the guy, of the character that was in the War World stuff.
Switching gears for a second, I'm a little pissed at John in this issue, or just the characterization of John in this issue, maybe a little bit, because he says, "What you said, the Fen believe that this is the afterlife. I think they might be right, at least for me. A war in the sky that never ends with no hope of victory or even rest. I'm not sure if that's reward or punishment, but I think it's probably what I deserve." Like, I get the idea of, like, he keeps getting pulled back into the fray and things, but I don't know, the whole "that's probably what I deserve" aspect of it. I feel like, didn't John let go of some of this stuff? Even for better or worse, in the Jeffrey Thorne run or whatever, and everything else we've ever had with John over the past several years, is he still punishing himself for shit? Like, it's getting old a little bit, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard, and who knows? Maybe they'll try to explain some of this again. Not that anybody has acknowledged this, or probably will, is the fact that, don't forget, technically speaking, this isn't even our John Stewart. This is the Hypertime John Stewart, which is so stupid. There were many lousy things Thorne did, but that was even the stupidest thing. If we're gonna have John, two Johns, couldn't we get the real John? Couldn't the real John be the one that sticks around, and the other John be the one out exploring and looking for a universe wherever, or a timeline when his wife still exists, among other things? I don't know. I agree with you.
I'm sorry. It's just like, I get that what Phil Kennedy, because Phil Kennedy Johnson is a soldier. Like, he was in the armed forces. So, like, I get, you know, telling it from that perspective, the whole, like, even when you come home, the war is never over. Some people come home and they can't let go of their soldier life, so they reenlist again and again and again. I get that, and it's not like Philip Kennedy Johnson is one of us in terms of he knows everything, but it seems like we've been here over and over and over again, whether Philip Kennedy Johnson knows it or not. We've just been here so many times. It's like, why do we have to keep coming back to this he can't let go of the fight thing? If anything, I wish he would embrace that side of himself. I can't let go of the fight. I am who I am. I'm a soldier. You know, like, okay, then now I have this all powerful power. Nut up or shut up. You know, like, I have the weapon. I have the will. I have the smarts. I have the training. Why not just lean into it instead of always trying to resist it and going, oh, woe is me, I keep getting pulled back into it. I don't know. I'm just done with it.
No, I can understand the frustration there. I think on some basic levels, this book is pretty frustrating across the board. Even when you have some good stuff, like this issue is definitely a step in the right direction compared to what we've gotten. But it kind of is a frustrating book when you go back. I mean, when we do the postmortem on this book, that I think that's going to be probably an ongoing sentiment, is that it is or has been very frustrating, especially because it did start with a lot of promise, and then it kind of went off the rails the way it did, which, of course, it always, I guess, like we discussed last issue, destined to go off the rails, because this is the way the story was designed. It was never not going to be able to go off the rails, because it was never going to really work well the way it was plotted and structured, that eventually those chickens were going to come home to roost. I don't know, and it just seems like this is, even when you have an interesting issue here, the majority of the interesting stuff is really all exposition, and the stuff in the issue itself is not really. I mean, you can't really say much. I mean, other than the Ellie in quotes getting attacked by the Star Shroud, which all of a sudden that name pop. I mean. I like the way that name just seemingly popped up out of nowhere, and now we're supposed to refer to Varen, I guess, as the Star Shroud, but it doesn't really matter. But other than her being attacked physically in this issue, that there's really nothing that moves that. That's pretty much just the same shit that we've been dealing with in the last couple of issues. Shepard, like I said, his storyline has been neutered ever since John was removed, that he's doing really nothing. And the stuff that John is doing, it's just not particularly interesting. So it seems like the same thing. Every issue he stands and he fights, the Dark Star power, and they have a moderate, they're able to survive and beat it back a little bit. But, and the super unhelpful Obi-Wan character is telling him what he points out in this issue. He tells all he keeps doing is telling him what he can't do. So It's a step in the right direction, but when you realize you still have three more issues of this book and John Stewart's not getting out of this place until, at the very least, issue 12, that's kind of tough.
Matt Gardner's apartment, do you think it's like that because it's just like probably an abandoned building and no one would think to look here for valuable information and stuff like the Book of Oa? Do you think it's like this because Guy Gardner lives there? Is Guy Gardner a slob? Or is just Guy Gardner hasn't been there for a while? Maybe somebody else did this to this place or was squatting? Because I don't see Guy Gardner bringing ice back to this place and her being okay with it.
I think it's more a combination of Guy being a slob and the fact that Guy hasn't, Guy probably has barely had any time in recent years, or literally potentially, but certainly in years and hour time and reader time, he's barely spent any time at home. So do I think he's this much of a slob inherently? I'd like to think not, though you can make a case it would suit his personality. But the reality is, it's probably just that he barely has time to come home, sit on the can, take a shower, and then he's got to go back out again, literally. So that's probably exactly what, you know, what you see is what you see is what you get here. It's more interesting when he took the Book of Oa and whether he just, I know he gave this little sobs, this little ha 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 story, not a sob story, a ha 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 story about, you know, don't tell anybody else that I have this because they might be other, you know, other lanterns might be mad at me, even though you would think if anything, he took it to protect the Book of Oa from all the United Planet douchebags. But we don't really know.
Yeah, that's definitely something you wouldn't want to fall into their hands. Nobody should have the access to that except for the Guardians and the Green Lantern Corps, to be honest with you.
This is true.
Too much information for one person to have. But yeah, in a way, Guy Gardner's probably the perfect person to be the one hiding it because he doesn't give a shit. He's not going to go opening it and start reading and trying to figure everything out. He's just like, I don't give a shit, but I know who shouldn't have it.
And I'll bury it under 10 pairs of crusty underwear, so they'll that won't be the first place they'll be looking.
I am curious about these Guardians, these Malthusians that were heroes for a bit, because with these tools, the Malthusian explorers became heroes for a time, using their newfound power in service of order. So I'd be curious for how long they patrol. Is it just these four?
Or whatever number. If it is just four, let's go back and look at the double page spread.
There's just four.
Four would make sense. Paper. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that I do believe that it was just that for those four. Would it have stayed that way indefinitely? Maybe not, but you know, because they were testing out the power essentially, and then plus the whole thing of, you know, the power corrupting and everything too, that they were probably getting off on having the power and basically being like another variation, like on the first lanterns or whatever that we saw in the Jessica and Simon book. When we went back to the original seven or whatever lanterns that there were after we keep getting retcon after retcon after retcon and things like that. But it's somewhat interesting. It adds another layer to the Guardians and everything else. In a way, this would have played better for me if we didn't basically get something similar, though not as much of a JeffCon, because this is not necessarily a JeffCon, because this is just stuff we never knew before. This is stuff that I don't think they've ever delved into the history of the Dark Stars or anything like that before. So
hard to say because I've never read that series.
Yeah, but I'm sure they didn't give us this. I could be wrong, but I would bet that we didn't get anything close to this. So the stuff in the Alan Scott book, which is where I was going with this, is more of a JeffCon because they had to reconcile things that we already knew to make room for the stuff they were adding in. But this is more like a hidden chapter of a book so it's kind of a JeffCon because it doesn't necessarily contradict things we saw before. But this is more like we just found a whole hidden chapter of a book. This is the secret origins of the Dark Stars. So it's stuff that you never saw any of this before. And yeah, so he does a good job tying this in. Again, you would have time to think about it since he's creating all of this, but tying it into the ring and the Revenant Queen. And so it's like I said, it's a little too late to have it be a meaningful payoff, but at least this. If it wasn't tied to this old gods crap, that having this background of this is where this power came from, this is why it's somewhat related to the Spectrum, this is how it's related to the Guardians, thus related to the Green Lantern Corps, that stuff would have been fine. It's just the fact tying it into the old gods, it would be, if you tied it into the new gods, nobody gives a shit about that stuff. They really don't. Nobody in quotes, of course, with a small N, because there's always somebody. But the reality is, you know, nobody cares. So it's unfortunate that that was the road that he went down, because with this part of it added in, it actually makes it more interesting.
Do you think so? Is Olgrin in them from the universe before this, or is he just old, super old in this universe?
I think that's open to interpretation. Probably the world before,
because nothing's supposed to be older than the Malthusians. Well, no, I guess not, because life began on Earth, right? That was the lie, right?
Yeah, and besides, we know. I mean, we had the new gods, and they were the old god. You know, the third world, fourth world, whatever hell up world we're up to now. I worked under the assumption that they're referring to the previous set of gods before the new gods, but we don't know. We really don't know. And again, most people don't care.
Yeah. All right. I mean, that's all I got for this, unless you have anything.
No, not about the issue. No, the issue is,
I think this might be a better read in trade, and I think it'll be a very pretty trade with all of Montos's art. But I did say that also about the Grant Morrison run, because of Liam Sharp. That's his name, right?
Yes.
Yeah, his art. But to be fair, there's not a whole lot I dislike more scripting and plot wise than the Grant Morrison series. So I like this better than that. So it'll be a prettier book and a better read and trade, I think, than the Grant Morrison stuff.
Yeah. And to me, sometimes I translate Chad East as saying, oh, it's a nice looking book, which basically means I don't like the story, but it's nice to flip through the pages.
Well, I admit I'm not like all the way back on the tracks or whatever, but like doing this, because you and I are locked into this till the end of the thing anyways, win, lose, or draw, and we were going to be for a while, unless it went way off the rails issue one or whatever, we could have been like, you know what, done. We're not going to subject ourselves to that. This brought me back a little bit because of the tie to the Malthusians. Okay, they're going after powers. They're trying to, you know, they decided to guard the universe or whatever, but they haven't yet figured out how. So they're exploring the universe, trying to find power. They found this, which is a little bit older than them. Okay, great. Got it. That's cool. So it kind of brought me back into something I'm interested in and curious about and everything like that, as opposed to something I cared nothing for. It just connected, you know, it gave me a little bit more than I had before. But like you said, for anyone other than us, it's probably too late for a lot of people. So,
yeah. And that's why, again, from a sales perspective, it'll be interesting to see how the May book ends up selling, because that is the first book that actually came out after everybody knew the book was already canceled. So it'll be, that's why it'll be interesting, just to see if there's any change from April sales to May sales, because that's the first one that people really had the opportunity to realize, oh, this book is not only potentially do I not like this book, but this book is ending at 12 anyway. So it's not like I have to potentially ride this out and hope that it's going to get, that this arc might suck, but the book's going to continue, and I don't want to get lost. I want to stick with it, as opposed to, oh, it's going to be ending, so I might as well just jump off now.
All right. Where are we going next?
Let's do the sales real quick on this book, since I only have sales through issue 8, which as I referenced, is the April issue. Now, let me ask you this question. I'm sure it's a two-pronged question. The first part, I'm sure it's the first part is a no-brainer. But the second, I'll just be curious what your answer to the second part is. Now, you probably don't have to go out on much of a limb to suspect, to be able to tell me which issue of this book was the best-selling book.
I mean, usually the first issue.
Correct. The more interesting question is, where do you think it fell? I can, if you need a clue, if you want to ask me a range, I can give you a range. But if you, but
70s. Like, when you say where do you think it fell, you mean where in the rankings do I think issue one was when it?
Yes.
Okay. Higher or lower?
It did better than the 70s. I apologize.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I was gonna say I'd be surprised if it was 60s, probably 50s or 60s. I can't imagine it being breaking the top 50.
No, it was 59.
Okay.
So doing a quick walkthrough on this from issue 1 to issue 8 thus far.
Oh, tell the people what's on the list. Is it just Big Two or is it indie stuff included?
I believe it's indie stuff included too.
Okay.
I believe so.
It usually is, but sometimes people do.
Yeah, as far as I know, looking at the Comic Book Revolution is where I get this. I wanted to throw that out there too. I believe it's independent stuff too. I don't think it's just DC.
And there's lots of good independent stuff out there right now that people are really into, like Saga's back, for example. So, yeah.
All right. So going in order from 1 to 8, 59, 109, 160, 137, 126, 108, and that's the 3 months in a row up until the where it was gaining, then down to 169, and number 8 moved back up to 134. So there was not a huge drop. There wasn't a substantial continual falling off the cliff after having the worst sales of all with issue 7 at 169. It did gain back to 134. But when you look at this, it's obviously only been in the top 100 once. And the average ranking of the first 8 issues is 125, which ain't good. But that's why I'll be curious to see again where the May issue falls and to see if it goes back up again or whether it falls.
So just for people to understand, because they, you know, they might not follow the numbers and stuff like that, like you like to, this is like the top 200 or so of how many. I know that changes based on how many publishers, how many issues they decide to put out a given month. Some publishers put out 2 issues of the same series in a month if they're doing double releases and stuff like that. So the actual total of issues out available on the market can probably adjust. But is 200 probably a good representation of all the comics out on the market on a given month? Or is it 200 of 300, 200 of 400?
It's definitely more than 200. We know there's more than 200 because of the fact that if something is quote unquote unranked, then usually that just means that doesn't fall into the top 200.
Well, I'm just saying, in order to give people context of when you say it fell to, you say 159, is that actually bad? Or like if let's say for, I know you're not saying this, but let's say, for example, it was just, there are, let's say, give or take about 200 issues of comic books in a given month. If you say it fell to 159, that's pretty bad if only there are 200 issues. But if it's 159 of 500 issues out on the month, it's still in the top whatever, right? So, like, I just want to give context when you say when it fell to a specific number.
Anything out of the top 100 usually is shaky as far as its long-term prognosis. When you start getting into anything that's probably beyond, trying to be conservative here, anything that's consistently selling like 130 or below, usually then you can almost throw it into the dreaded dead book walking category, which is what, you know, the John Stewart book based on sales long before we had the announcement, as we went through those numbers. I mean, John Stewart's really, other than the first issue, you can make a case it's pretty much been walking the line of a book that would, at least some people will look at and say, okay, if this doesn't start improving soon, depending on, of course, your investment in said title, that this would be something we definitely could consider pulling the plug on. So you look at something I didn't pull up all the numbers, but the Alan Scott book in particular. The Alan Scott book is consistently selling really bad, lower, like probably consistently, when I can go back and put the list together. Well, at least, but once we get the final results, obviously, for the last issue that just came out, which we just talked about, which will be a while. But the reality is, it seemed like that book was pretty consistently selling like in the 160s. So that book, from a sales perspective, pretty much was a dead book walking. Even if it was not set up to be a mini, that based on sales, you'd say, okay, there's really, by sales alone, there's really no reason necessarily that this book should survive long term. That's why you and I talked about the Sinister Sons. I forget the number I told you, but the Sinister Sons, number one, issue number one, still didn't even fall into the top 100. And then issues 2 and 3 were out of the top 200. So that's a book clearly nobody is buying. And, you know, again, nobody, in quotes with small n, nobody's buying and nobody cares about. But yeah, so it's, and what constitutes, based on pure sales, what's number one this, you know, what's number 50 this month, may not be the same criteria for what's number 50 next month. Like it is like a book that's number 50 this month based on sales could actually sell many fewer copies on what's number 50 next month, depending on what's out and how things are doing. But still, it's just you still rank them the way you rank them. So
yeah.
You can break it down into the number of copies and things or units sold, but based on overall rankings, that's pretty much the best you can do, because of course a lot of these numbers are not like made super available for everyone to delve deep into.
All right, what's next?
I don't know what is next. Oh, I know what's next. Do you want to talk about the Venom trailer?
I do. Venom 3, aka Venom the Last Dance. They dropped this trailer and ran super quick. They didn't do a bunch of teasers and lead-ins and stuff. They just, bam, here's the trailer, enjoy. So I'm good with that. Watching the trailer, I got to tell you, I know that they don't do this. Well, actually, you know what? They do this on TV now every now and then, especially during like games and stuff like that. The teaser before the trailer.
Yeah, I hate that shit.
Showing you the quick little clips of things you're going to see in the trailer is fucking insane. What are you doing? I don't understand. Like, I'm already upset at the idea when people are like, hey, the trailer's going to drop. The full-length trailer is going to drop in 2 weeks. But let's make a big deal out of this teaser of the trailer. That's already crazy to me, but I can see how people get excited about it just in terms of I'm going to get a look at the thing before the thing actually hits, like whatever. Fine. There's only so many advanced things you can get excited about. The advance of the advance is fucking crazy. The idea that you have to put quick clips teasing the trailer you're about to watch in 2 seconds anyways is fucking crazy to me. I don't know why they do that. But anyways. Yeah, the trailer. So, we're not going to recap it like a comic book, but like, I thought it was okay. I gotta say, the comedy's wearing thin on me a little bit. Like Venom, as a Venom fan, like there's some, and always has been some inherent, there's some inherent comedy and humor to it. Like a dark comedy. In some ways. So that's totally fine, but it's starting to wear thin a little bit, a little campy, a little bit too much. Also the whole sync up issue, like where like we are Venom and they keep talking, Venom's getting a little too eager. And so Venom, the symbiote and Eddie are supposed to have like a telepathic connection that they've never played with. Like, I get that maybe this is just their own interpretation, so they're never going to do that. So trying to judge it for what they didn't decide to adapt is probably a thing I shouldn't be doing. But it does, their connection not being as deep and as rooted as what I'm used to has, now that I reflect on it, always been a small concern. But as we get further in this franchise, it's getting more and more apparent to me. So there's that. How this is going to fit into the overall trajectory of their story together across this trilogy, because as IMDb says, it's their last dance, it'll bring the curtains down on Venom and Eddie's last dance. So, you know, whether Eddie and Venom die or they ride off heroically into the sunset, no more stories to be told, which, you know, if things like Madam Web and Morbius keep happening, let's face it, Sony's going to go back to the well and bring another Venom movie out. That's pretty much a guarantee. I don't know. I'm very curious because we see him briefly, and forgive me, you probably know, Mark, how to pronounce his name. The guy who played Kurt Connors, the actor that's in this movie.
Rhys Afans or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. He's in here and people are like, is he Kurt Connors? Is he this universe's version of Kurt Connors? Is he a new character entirely? We see him for half a second. So whatever. We do know that Stefan Graham is in here, who was in the previous movie, the detective who becomes, you know, canonically in the comics, becomes the host for Toxin, which is Carnage's offspring, the same way Carnage is an offspring of Venom. So it'd be interesting if Toxin teams up with Venom to face the threat, and that's his kind of help out of this. If Reese, this guy is Kurt Connors. If he becomes the Lizard and helps them out, I don't know. We'll see. Some people online are freaking out about what's his name? Chiwetel?
UFOR or whatever. It's going to be curious whether he's actually playing Mordo.
Yeah, doubtful. The one thing people are freaking out online about, maybe to more of a degree than they should be, but I also do see a bit of the, for lack of a better term, the venom that some of the people on the fans online have for this decision. The idea that the little alien sludge that was left behind in the end of the Spider-Man movie is actually still in this Venom universe and they just capture it right off the thing, as opposed to leaving that in the MCU as a way to get Venom in the MCU, is fucking crazy. They had that set up and it was like, oh man, there's a piece of the symbiote left behind in this universe. Oh my God. At least that's what people interpreted. Obviously that's not what ended up happening. It turns out it was left behind in the bar that he was at in his universe. I don't know. And at least that's what the trailer seems to be saying here. It's crazy that you cracked open the door and kind of figured out a way to get Venom into the MCU and then fucking took it back. What the hell?
Well, until we see what they actually do, we don't 100% know.
That's true. Yeah. But that was crazy to me. Honestly, I don't know what's happening in this movie. When you tell me Carnage is going to be showing up in like the second film and stuff like that, like at least I have some idea. And all the supporting cast that Carnage had in that, his girlfriend, like at least you give me places I can go mentally where the story obviously is going to be a big versus story and so on and so forth. So like there's that. But like I have no idea where this is going to go. And I'm sure there are rumors out there, but we know I don't pay attention to those as much as I can, at least unless I accidentally stumble across them, especially when it comes to projects that I personally would be interested in or excited for, looking forward to, like Venom. Like, regardless of, I'm going to see this movie. It's fucking Venom. Like, we all know that. But like, I don't know where they're going with this. The idea that he's being hunted by this massive Black Ops team, and also all of a sudden this more symbiotes are here. Like, And whatever that entails, small continuity issue I had. Venom being on the plane and fighting this other thing when in the first movie he had to duck and scream because of the sound of a plane passing overhead. Is he building up a resistance? I don't know, but there's a little bit of a continuity mistake there. So him being able to fight on a plane without being affected by the sound of said plane is a little whatever for me, but that's just a small thing, I guess. Everybody's liking the horse thing. I think that's funny. I don't know. I thought it was a good first trailer for not knowing a goddamn thing that's going to happen. And it really didn't tell me much about what this story is about, which I guess first trailers never really do. So, okay.
There are some things about what this movie is supposed to be about, and actually a lot of it relates to what Madam Web at one point was supposed to be about, but they changed it. There was supposed to be who Ezekiel Sims was really trying to kill in the original draft, and what basically what Dakota Johnson signed up for was a lot different than what we got. And part of the reason rumor wise that happened is because they took that subplot and they threw it into Venom 3. To a certain extent, obviously, Ezekiel Sims isn't hunting anybody. But the idea that the character that needed to be protected in Madam Web is now going to be the character that somehow Eddie and Venom have to protect in this movie. Which, without going into spoilers for your sake more than anything else, because it's a rumor, so it's not a spoiler because we don't know if it's true. It messes with a time frame. It doesn't seem to really mesh time frame wise, but from a continuity perspective, if it's true, then it would explain potentially why if Reese is playing Kurt Connors, why he can play Kurt Connors, without it having to be post No Way Home, that it wouldn't be a retcon of anything there. But I think the trailer is okay. I agree. It doesn't, you know, it kind of gives, it certainly makes it seem like it's some variation on the Planet of Symbiotes thing. But the reality is you don't get a lot out of this. It's still weird. I mean, about what they're going, it, the odds are, if anything, they're going to just separate Eddie from Venom. And that's going to be how probably it would end, I would suspect, because for whatever reason, either he doesn't want to do them anymore, or they just only had the contract with him for three movies. That it seems like the most of the word on the street is just that, you know, Tom, you know, this is like Tom Hardy. Tom, this is like Tom Hardy's last go in this. Though I would certainly would suspect that if it was going to be Tom Hardy, that if you said, hey, guess what? You versus Tom Holland in the next one, it's like, okay. Then mm-hmm. I'm sure he would probably come back for that. But the reality is, I think Sony's big problem is that their continuity, even in a multiverse, even when you have all, you know, you already have multiple Spider-Men to choose from and different things. It's like their inability to have any kind of straightforward, the inability to at least have a straight diverging timeline or connecting the dots. It's like A, B, and C take you over here, and that's all, and all these things happen over here, and D, E, and F go over here. It's just, it's kind of a cluster. And I don't know if, again, if some of the rumors are true, this isn't going to make it any less clustered. But, and I don't know how people would react to it, but we'll see. It was not a bad first trailer, and we'll see how it goes.
I just had the, as you were talking, I had the trailer playing in the background on mute. And one thing I forgot to mention, I know it was like a thing in the first film, like when he did that jump on the motorcycle and then like the symbiote reached out, grabbed the bike. And there's been a couple of those, like, let's separate Eddie from the symbiote and use the stretch and like all that ability. The idea of the symbiote, like allowing Eddie to throw it, like throwing Eddie at some, like as somebody while the symbiote itself attacks somebody else, but they're still connected and Eddie's drop kicking somebody. That's crazy to me. That's that, like, I get like the whole, like from a production point of view, from a studio point of view, you want to see your big budget movie action actor's face, so let's separate him a couple of times, let's split the symbiote open and see Eddie's face, and let's do this and that. But the idea of the symbiote kind of throwing Eddie at other people to help attack, like that, as a symbiote fan, that the symbiote protects the host, like I that not to say, like, in God, how long has Venom been around at this point? 40 years maybe. I'm 37, dude, and Venom's been around.
Well, forty would take us what, to the 90s? Would it be the 90s? Okay, that might be accurate.
I'm not saying it's never happened in, you know, about 40 years of storytelling, but to the extent that they're doing it, the symbiote protects the host. It's the entire reason Venom just doesn't go off on his own and do his own thing as a single entity, as a symbiote. It doesn't. Is because a symbiote needs, it's in the fucking name, it needs a host. So like I don't like the idea when we see in this trailer here, especially towards the beginning of the Venom kind of half throwing Eddie in a drop kick to somebody else as he's doing his own thing over on the side. That's fucking crazy to me. I'm sorry. That's just that's bonkers.
It is 40. Actually, it's almost literally 40. Yeah. Actually, it's over 40 because it was May 1984. I forgot. But that's counting the costume. That's counting the black costume.
Oh, okay. So that's so Secret Wars.
Yeah,
is 40 this year?
Actually, it was yeah. But if you go in, the first full appearance wasn't, and this is where my mind was. The first full appearance wasn't until May 1988. So it's still knocking on. It's only a 4-year difference. So it's 36. But either way, so it's 40 years since Spider-Man first had the black costume. And they're counting that as for the Amazing Spider-Man issue, the 252 issue. Okay. We know where he got it. We got it in Secret Wars, but I guess that's the homage cover to the original Amazing Fantasy cover when he's wearing the black suit. So that was in May 84, and then 4 years later in May of 88 is when you had the first full in Amazing Spider-Man 300. Of Venom. So yeah, so essentially it is 40, which is kind of just shows you how friggin' old I am too. Oh god.
Yeah, it's and if we get rid of Eddie and keep Venom, then where are we going? Are we going Flash Thompson? How do you go Flash Thompson without Spidey? Because in terms of popular adaptations of Venom, the Agent Venom storyline stuff, what was that fucking, was that Rick Remender that was doing Agent Venom when it was Flash Thompson? Sorry, let me look at my shelf here to the left because I have the first trade of the, yeah, Rick Remender. That was probably the most popular non-Eddie version of Venom was Flash Thompson.
Yeah, I think that's I think that's true, but we'll have to see what they do. They may, who knows? I mean, that could be the, based on the also what happens in this movie, if that some of those rumors are true, maybe they will try to set up something with some Spider-Man Venom literal team up in that sense, depending on circuit. Or they could be paving a way for that in Secret Wars.
It's true. It's true. All right. What else do we want to talk about tonight?
Let me do this real quick. What has Mark seen?
Mark's movie minute.
Mark has seen In a Violent Nature, which is the IFC movie, the horror movie they released for like 2 weeks, and it's going to be on Shudder in 2 weeks. Yeah, it's an odd one. It's, the kills are interesting. It's a relatively boring. Other than the camera angles, they do some interesting camera angles from the killer's point of view, or just in general, they just do interesting camera angles for kills in this movie. But other than that, hold on. Have you ever, you know the old trope about how back in the, certainly Zombie Jason falls into this category along with Michael Myers, that, hey, everybody can run all the time, but all they have to do is walk and they catch up to you. Well, you kind of see how that works in those movies, because there's a whole lot of walking done by the killer in this movie, and you see almost all of it. the ending is very, very, very odd, very anticlimactic. I think I understand what it's supposed to mean, and as long as it does mean that, then you can't say it doesn't make any sense, but it's very anticlimactic. So I would say, yeah, if you have Shudder or can have access to it, I certainly wouldn't be paying in the theater to go see it. And out of curiosity, as we're recording this, I have seen the first two episodes of The Acolyte, which is not certainly not as horrible as most people thought or predicted it was going to be, but it's only the first two episodes, and I do hear bad things are coming. So I'll probably have a better idea after next week, but for the first two, I kind of liked it for what it was. I was not bored. I was not turned off by it. It made me want to keep watching. So let's see what happens. I think that's all I had, because I'm sure you want to talk about GL June.
Yeah, we'll end with that. I did want to mention real quick the thing I should mention to you today, but if you guys are liking the Green Lantern main series, the trade paperback is out this week as we record this. So the first volume is out. It's volume one, called Back in Action. There are actually two covers out there. This doesn't often happen for trades, so it's kind of worth mentioning just in case. The issue one, the Zermanico cover with, Kilowog and that hoodie and the jets and all that stuff, that's the main cover for the trade paperback. The variant cover is the Ivan Reis, whatever we're calling it, cover from issue one that we got with Hal and the people in the bubble behind him. That is a direct market version. I don't know what that means in terms of what places are supposed to have it, but I picked mine up off of instocktrades.com. Right now it's 42% off, so it's $11.59. I don't know if it'll still be that by the time this actual episode comes out, because this is the first week it hits, and usually things are a little bit cheaper on the first week of release or so on InStock Trades. But right now I ran a search on InStock Trades, and everything Green Lantern related I'm looking at least 42% off. So that's beneficial. But I picked that up. I'm not sure if direct market means like comic book shops will have the variant version, and like the regular version will be like, I don't know, Amazon's and Walmart and stuff like that. So whatever, but there are two covers for this trade if you're looking for it, just FYI. And it's pretty cheap right now in a few places if you want to go find it. So there's that. But yes, we should end on GL June, because it is as we record this, it's June 5th, and already two parts of this are out for you guys to listen to. The first part came out over on Emerald Echo, over on the Multiverse Musings Podcast Network on YouTube, from Donnie and Adam. They did a great job on their coverage. Emerald Echo is only available on YouTube as far as I'm aware, so go check it out over there. And then Myron and Phil just put out theirs today, actually, as we record this. Came out this morning. And they are up, obviously, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, stuff like that. But they are also up on YouTube. They've been playing up the YouTube thing as well. I feel bad for them. I don't know if you know about this, Mark. They actually had to record that twice because Myron forgot to hit the record button the first time.
No, that's horrible.
We've done that before, but it always sucks trying to have to like remember your good points that you brought up. Plus, you don't have the same energy the second time around because you're like, we've been here before. I can't really act and pretend that what I'm saying is revelatory to me, you know, that whole thing. So I felt so bad for them that they had to record it twice, but it's good coverage. I don't think their recording necessarily shows any signs that it's, you know, it probably most definitely would have been better the first time around because the second one's so awful. It's not in any way, shape or form that. I had fun watching their video. So, I watched it this morning before I clock in for work. So it's good to me. And I enjoyed it. So first two parts are out over there. And next part will be Dark Stars coverage from Dan over on Mosaic Comics. So and then after that, we have Will with Green Lanterns podcast and then us at the end of the month. So GL June all through the month of June. But you guys, you know, you've got two parts out there already for you to listen to.
Rolling, rolling, rolling.
All right. Anything else?
Probably, but I can't think of anything at the moment.
All right. Well, if people want to reach out to us, how do they do so?
Lanterncast.com is the website, lanterncast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, #GeoCast. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, whatever platform you listen to us on. Please leave us a positive review. Last but not least, if you'd like to leave us a text or a voicemail, 708-LANTERN, and let us know what you think.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night.